Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is Ash Amin. Until last year Professor of Geography at the University of Durham, Ash Amin now holds the 1931 Chair in Geography at Cambridge. He's known for his work on the geographies of modern living and globalisation as an everyday process that thoroughly reconstitutes meanings of the local. He's also contributed to thinking on the economy as cultural entity, and his writings on race and multiculturalism have helped change policy work on the management of ethnic diversity. I met Ash Amin in Cambridge recently to talk about his latest book, Land of Strangers. Most modern societies are nothing more than a collection of strangers, Amin contends. Public and political awareness of the stranger has become acute. Nobody wants the immigrant or the asylum seeker. The stranger has become a figure of fear and hate, to be contained and disciplined. Land of Strangers argues that humanist policies of inclusiveness are not up to the demands of our extraordinarily cosmopolitan age. The book instead calls for a different kind of politics of togetherness, one in which a certain sort of civility of indifference to difference might be cultivated. And it looks at how this attitude might play out in reality, at the level of the state, but also in our habits of daily living, through which we might experiment in order to become unperturbed by the presence of the stranger in our midst. In other words, ways in which a different politics of the stranger may be forged. In the introduction, Ash Amin talks of the urgency of the political moment. I began by asking him about the timeliness of Land of Strangers.
Yes, I think it is timely in a couple of senses. I think at the moment, and many would agree, certainly this is known in the social sciences, we're seeing a radical deepening of surveillance society, of everything that moves, monitored, and everything that's deemed to be unacceptable, effectively disciplined or put under control. So there is a real heightened anxiety about the body that doesn't quite fit, the stranger, as I try and argue in the book. And so I think this deepening of surveillance society, targeting particular individuals, goes hand in hand with, and it, I think probably overlaps with, much longer standing anxieties, particularly in the West, towards the figure of the stranger, the discrepant figure, the outsider. And so I think this book is timely in the juxtaposition of these two things, long-standing, deep-rooted anxiety, now being really quite viscerally flared up by a new punitive biopolitics.
We'll come back to biopolitics anon. I was struck reading the book that the word aversion comes up a great deal. And it seemed to me that was highly descriptive of this attitude that you're talking about, the attitude which is becoming more pervasive of stigmatizing, separating, and turning away from.
Yes, that's exactly right. Aversion as a word and aversion as a public sentiment falls back to the reign of history. It was there during the world's very dark periods, from Nazism through to other forms of genocide or Holocaust. And the word has come back into the lexicon, I think, into even the popular mindset. And I think that's happened because there's a general underlying fear in modern Western society about the East, about potential terrorists, about climate change, about our place on the globe, about the future of Western culture as such, about all sorts of things which, in one word, you call catastrophism, that the world is on the edge, not so much about to come to an end, but the world that we knew it would never be the same again. And so I think it's in that sort of broader cosmopolitan context that the word aversion has become, well, much more than just a diagnostic. I think it's become a way of signaling a possible future, one where, through the exercise of aversion, we might be able to, one might be able to avert impending doom.
The metaphor that you used a couple of times was that of the drawbridge, the pulling up of the drawbridge. And again, that goes along with, you know, the turning your back on something and pulling up and just building up your own fortress and your own defences, and what is outside you want to keep outside.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this kind of move is, of course, politically manipulated as well. But it also preys on, if you like, a kind of generalized sentiment of wariness of the future and weariness of the cosmopolitan society, of the mixed hybrid open society. So I think a fear of this sort, coupled to a clear set of instructions, if you like, from political elites and from the media, that, in the way that Foucault described, that society must defend itself somehow, I think converts very quickly into a desire for the world that you once knew.
Whether that's a real or an imaginary world.
Oh, absolutely. And almost always, I think it's an imaginary world, almost always, that you're told and you're led to believe that that world used to exist once upon a time. And it used to exist at a time when immigration was controlled, when there were not many asylum seekers, when national culture was homogeneous, when states really were states rather than these perforated, punctured entities that they've become. And so it's time to draw the bridge up, to protect the vulnerable castle.
When you decided to write this book, Ash, you not only wanted to provide an analysis of the situation as you see it, you also wanted it to be in part polemical. Tell me why.
Well, there are many works of scholarship on the current times, and there are many explanations of our times as awkward, as difficult, as decidedly against the stranger. So in that sense, I think I was trying to contribute to an ongoing theme of scholarship. But I felt that in the scholarship there was very little about what might be done to rectify the current circumstances, what might be done to nudge thinking and also politics with a small p in a new direction towards the inclusive in the open society. So I felt that a book with normative concerns ought to be written, you know, just to begin a broader reflection on the makings of a non-catastrophic, non-punitive society. Now, there are some alternatives, and in this area concerning the figure of the stranger, my feeling was that the prevalent alternative was all about getting strangers to become friends, getting national majorities to begin to engage with national, with national and non-national minorities, and to get minorities to become more integrated by playing a bigger and greater role in society and getting to know majorities. And I was deeply frustrated by this kind of thinking. I wanted to look for a politics for the stranger and of the stranger, which didn't require of strangers to become friends with each other or with the host community. I felt that that kind of politics was just too narrow and impossible, quite frankly, in a very cosmopolitan age.
Maybe before we go any further, I should ask you to define what exactly you mean by the stranger. Is it a rather shifting term?
Yes and no. By the stranger I mean the usual suspects. Minorities, usually visible minorities, migrants, visible migrants, asylum seekers, the Roma, and other historically targeted populations. But I also mean something more than that. What's, I think, settled in place is the figure of the stranger, and not necessarily the individual who wears the coat. Because today, my sense is that labeling somebody a stranger and in negative ways has become a vicarious pastime. At any given moment in time, if particular groups are deemed to be unwanted or ill-fitting, then I think they also are enrolled into the world of the animal, the stranger, time handlers, the obese, perhaps smokers, litigants, and of course in the most recent times, youth, students too.
So it's really a stigma that can be attached to almost any group which the majority, the elite, deem undesirable as part of society.
Yes, that's exactly right. And precisely because the politics of our times are a politics of defining and keeping the stranger out. This is a time of targeting particular bodies. This is a time in which it is felt that if the future is compromised, it is because of certain bodies.
You're using bodies there in a corporeal, somatic sense rather than an institutional sense.
I am, absolutely, corporeal and somatic. And they don't have to be human bodies. I mean, if you think about how scary things can become when we feel that there's a pandemic around the corner, then the bodies that irk us are also viral bodies.
And of course, we think about the vectors for those viruses, don't we? And those vectors tend to be human. You know, again, there's an opportunity to stigmatize a certain group or a certain population because we deem them to be likelier as carriers of that virus.
That's exactly right. And every time we've had some kind of influenza epidemic or pandemic suspected, it's always traced back to some figures engaged in putatively suspect agricultural practices somewhere in the world, but we always know that the first sneeze was somewhere in Asia or somewhere in Latin America in some community whose virus is then spread to us.
While we're talking about bodies, I was really intrigued by the idea that you put forward of the somatization of politics. Now, that may be an unfamiliar phrase to listeners. Can you say what you mean by that? Because that seems to me to tie up with what we've just been talking about.
Well, by somatization of politics, just carrying on from where we were a second ago, it means constructing a politics around bodies, around feelings, around the sensory, around the matter of life itself. And so the matter of life itself becomes a sphere that people become acutely conscious of. To survive in the future becomes a challenge of creating the perfect body, for instance. To know something of the dangers that we face requires knowing something of the bodies that are dangerous. To find our own place in the world requires some knowledge of how a group of bodies make up a community and how another group of bodies are the nemesis of community or are part of another community that must live away and separately. And it's these sorts of feelings about life, about the divisions of life into community and territory and space, which I think along with others, is producing a somatic politics.
Was it 9/11, essentially, which marked the radical change between the multicultural politics of the 1990s and this new era that we find ourselves in? Was that the defining event that really changed everything?
I think it is in many ways. 9/11 introduces a general sense of the future as catastrophic or potentially catastrophic, and therefore requiring a new, much tougher way of dealing with the so-called problems of society. And so I think with 9/11, politics of emergency and, in inverted commas, homeland security becomes fully legitimated. There's no longer any need now for political classes and elites and medias to be apologetic about being very tough on the sources of destabilization, on the sources of insecurity, which of course now in traumatic times are judged to be particular bodies. In this case, Muslims and would be terrorists. And so I think in that sense, 9/11 really was a decisive moment because it allowed, it was a turning point during, in which it became possible to vilify liberal, tolerant, open society. And of course, multiculturalism was the acme of the liberal, tolerant age.
You spoke earlier about feeling that the available humanist discourse wasn't really adequate. It wasn't providing the necessary, I guess, analytical or practical tools in order to take things forward, that those were sort of played out or reached a dead end. In which case, in order to create the kind of politics of integration that your book is searching for, what are the available analytical and pragmatic tools that we can experiment with?
I've been critical of humanism in the book, but I think it would be arrogant to dismiss humanism. I've been critical of a certain kind of humanism, one where humans are required to look upon each other in different ways. And I argue in the book that at a time like this, that's going to be very, very difficult. So I turn to a different kind of politics of integration in the book. You might call it it's a politics of talentless civilities, the number of different ways in which individuals and society in general can slowly learn to live with difference, hybridity, and openness. So the book returns emphatically to a politics of equality and justice, because without proper rights for the outsider and for subaltern figures, nothing great is going to happen. The book turns towards a politics of tough anti-racism and unfair pro-immigration policies. The book turns to the social state, which took many, many, many years to improve in post-war Europe, around, if you like, a politics of provisioning, that is, the providing welfare state as opposed to the catastrophe-oriented state that we find today that's immensely punitive. The book turns to the commons, to an idea of the shared turf as a way of bringing strangers together to occupy the same kind of space, to find, in inverted commas, togetherness through their joint effort in work, in sharing the public spaces of the city, where people learn to occupy a common space with other people without necessarily recognize their individuality, but just simply their right to be, to occupy a space. And the book turns to, summatively, practices of ethical being by living in the world in sensitive ways, sensitive to the environment, to those things that are cherished, to being in the company of strangers, to simply just learning to dwell in a composite ecology, in careful, sometimes courageous ways, but never punitive ways.
Just to take one example from the many you've just cited, that of the urban environment, And you made a very interesting remark, I thought, about how those environments might be designed in the broadest sense. And you talk about an aesthetic in the minor key, which I thought was a very interesting, suggestive idea. Can you explain what you meant by that aesthetic of the minor key?
Well, let's think about urban public space. City streets, squares, and other public spaces where bazaars, markets, retail parks, whatever, where a lot of people mingle amongst each other, where you find crowds, where you find people of all sorts, and in many countries, people also sharing that space with all kinds of non-humans. By and large, not a lot goes wrong. By and large, in these urban public spaces, well-used public spaces, there is a certain kind of civility at work. And parenthetically, there's no recognition amongst individuals going on at all. But in general, there's a certain kind of atmosphere of place that works behind our backs as a disciplining force, small d, small f. And I'm interested to know what is it that produces that kind of urban civility. And I'm convinced that it's the product of light forms of design.
And not overdetermined, not heavily determined, but polyvalent.
Polyvalent design, the structure and colour of buildings, the way in which public space is organized, the ways in which an enormously large space is broken down into small spaces that individuals can feel comfortable in and territorialize, as it were. The kind of visual iconography of that particular space, what the billboards say or don't say. So a whole series of things that make that public space, the metal, the software, the building, the concrete, the colors, the bodies, the swirls, the people who, in their togetherness, in their very close juxtaposition, in their movement in that space, make that space, and then that space develops a aesthetic of its own when it's filled up, which, as it were, talks back to the individuals who are in that space in a very silent way, and acts as a way of coding public behavior.
So the cityscape is very much more than a backdrop, but at the same time, it enables different usage and different ways of coming together or commingling or being side by side. So it's not determining it, but it's enabling it.
That's exactly right. The cityscape is like an ecology, and we humans dwell in that ecology. And in the dwelling of that ecology, we become who we are.
You've talked about some positives, some potential positives, but it has to be said there is quite a litany of negatives, of problems, and not least of those is what seems on your analysis to be really an ingrained racism, almost a sort of reflexive, fundamental racism at core. Tell me, I mean, are you pessimistic about that? Am I reading you correctly? And is that a deeply pessimistic analysis of the human condition?
It's a deeply pessimistic analysis of the current condition and not necessarily of the human condition. So I say in the book that I use this word, following the work of others, phenotypical racism, which is supposed to describe a kind of awareness of difference, malign in the minor key, where difference is seen, it somehow always becomes racialized. And so I argue in the book that form of racism has always been around, it hovers in the background, and it is the product of bodily difference being read as political differences, ethical differences, cultural differences, with the help of all sorts of historical sorting mechanisms that we've accumulated and are constantly reinforced by institutions. Which brings me to my next point. I said this is a particularly bad moment because phenotypical racism and its harms become escalated and become truly dangerous, as they have in the current period, because of a certain biopolitics. When something is made of racial difference by populations, by governments, by the media, by elites, and by racist movements. So I'm pessimistic about the present, because I think the present is a coming together of the durations of phenotypical racism and the one-offnesses, if you want, of biopolitical racism. Times get very difficult when the two come together. So I'm not historically pessimistic, although I do believe that racial tendencies have been around for a very long time and will never go away. But I do believe that with the right kind of organized politics, biopolitics, racist biopolitics, I think can be put back in the cupboard.
I mean, you write interestingly about Slavoj Žižek's idea of post-political biopolitics, which is, again, quite a pessimistic idea that we've kind of gone beyond a certain kind of politics, almost kind of been shunted into a sideline in which the only politics available, really, the only political discourse is one that's got this sort of biopolitical foundation, which again I found a pessimistic notion.
It's not easy to be optimistic at the moment, other than through a kind of progressive bipolar politics. I mean, I mentioned some of the components of such a politics earlier on. If the political will was there to return to the social state, to make something of the commons, to become indifferent to difference. And there are some real alternatives available. So I would see the current times as a jostle between positions, as a kind of war of the worlds. It is not to say that everything has been resolved or settled in the name of a catastrophic state, in the name of a punitive biopolitics. Look at the Occupy movement. Look at how the 99% literally around the world refuses to lie down and constantly wishes to make a case for itself, whether it's in looking to improve living conditions in slums, or to fight for better cities, or to fight for jobs, or the Arab Spring, or the continuation of social democracy in some European states. I think this is a pivotal moment. I wouldn't say the game is entirely up yet, because I think there are alternative desires, alternative organizations, alternative forms of community all over the world. But they don't quite add up at the moment, and I think that's part of the problem.
And is one of the ultimate tests the European Union, because there you seem to have impulses towards the good, towards inclusiveness, towards openness, towards tolerance. Potentially, even if some of it draws on a sort of imaginary vision of itself. And on the other hand, what we talked about earlier, the exclusiveness, the narrowing of the definition of who is allowed in, and this idea of the pulling up of the borders, and not to mention, you know, the rise of extremism, you know, and violence, and violence in rhetoric as well as in deed.
This is a delicate and a significant moment for Europe. And it is so because the European public sphere is an unfinished space. It is exactly as you described. On the one hand, Europe is seen to be the space of inclusion, tolerance, liberal values, social democracy, a commons for everybody. But equally, at the moment, partly because of the economic crisis, a new European public sphere is in the making. One that's extraordinarily punitive, inward-looking, very selfish, and against its peripheries and minorities. So almost everything depends, I think, on in the end, the kinds of tendencies that will colonize or not this fragile emerging European public sphere. It's never a good thing to speculate, but alternatively, you could imagine a time when, if the current economic and political situation gets much worse in Europe, communities and people and nations within Europe wanting a different Europe could actually begin to use the European public sphere as a way of signaling another way of being, one which is about jobs, about security, possibly even ultimately recognizing that Europe is nothing other than the coming together of national and non-national strangers, that the European public sphere is just that. It is a public space in which difference can be expressed, and people from different backgrounds come together and to make Europe what it is. It will take an awful lot of effort and an awful lot of bottom-up politics, I think, to produce that kind of new European public sphere. But it could happen on the grounds that the European public sphere at the moment is very much an incomplete space. It could become a space of becoming.
And how much is a return to economic, if not affluence, then at least stability and some degree of comfort, a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for the kind of politics of integration that you would like to see being gradually built? In other words, can it happen while we're in this sort of parlous economic state? Is it simply beyond the bounds of possibility that we could have the kind of advances while you're right in the majority population feeling threatened by all sorts of things? And that's likely to increase, isn't it, while economic instability persists?
It's very difficult to imagine a welfare Europe without a better, more equitable economy. That's true. But equally, if the current economic circumstances continue to get worse, it will produce at least two kinds of politics. One is, as we've been talking about, a politics of aversion and exclusion. But the other alternative, and we've seen signs of this through the Occupy movement, in the name of the 99%, is a politics of saying that if you're out of a job, so am I. I, the immigrant, came here to take your job, but there isn't a job to take, and you haven't got a job either. And so a new awareness might emerge, bottom up, that in conditions of economic severity and decline, almost everybody has become minoritized. Almost everybody stands together on the same playing field, one without any economic opportunity. And so it's conceivable that as that empty football field, if you like, becomes filled with all manner of bodies from all sorts of provenance and culture and geography, that full football field would want to make its own demands for a better future, for a more inclusive economy, for everybody. Sounds highly idealistic, but it's not impossible.
Let me ask you in conclusion, Ash. We talked earlier a little bit about catastrophe as a master narrative, and you write about that in the last chapter of the book, and you point out that there isn't really an available persuasive counter-narrative to the neoliberal /catastrophist narrative. How big a problem is that? Because, I mean, we, to an extent, we do live in our imaginations and we do live by grand narratives. And if there is no available or emergent counterweight to that, how big an issue is that for actually making the kind of progress that you're talking about?
I think it's an immense obstacle. It's absolutely huge. We, all of us, think in metaphors. The value of the utopian tradition wasn't necessarily the house on the hill that was promised. The value of the utopian tradition was in naming a possible future that would be very different from the present. The idea of utopia there signaled a certain kind of possible home stroke hope. And I think without that kind of trans narrative today, with its own keywords, keywords such as courage, hope, solidarity, social state, equality, justice, we don't have to invent lots of new words. The words are there already. But what seems to me what's really required is constructing an affective politics, a politics of real, Raymond Williams called it, new set of structures of feeling for a new way of living with different, without that kind of momentum, alternative language, which becomes a real language of popular feeling. It'll be very difficult to push back against neoliberalism. Almost impossible, because its keywords have become the sentiments that drive us. Its keywords have become the blood in our veins. So that's all got to change.
It's very good at co-opting other discourses, isn't it? Incorporating them within itself.
It's a master narrative.
I was talking to Ash Amin about his new book, Land of Strangers, which is out this spring in both hardback and paperback. For more details, visit the Polity Books website at politybooks.com. That's all for this podcast, but I'll be back again soon with more interviews with Polity authors. Do also look out for a growing number of videos on the Polity website. I hope you can join me again soon for our next programme, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.